Welcome to NBO Lit Fest. My name is Wanjiro Koinange.
And I'm Angela Washuka.
And this is A Palace for the People live. And today we are really, really, really honored to be joined by a very special guest, Miss Petina Gapa. Petina is a writer and lawyer from Zimbabwe. She is the author of two novels, Out of Darkness, Shining Light, and The Book of Memory, as well as two stunning short story collections called Rotten Row and An Elegy for Istanbul. Petina has been listed and shortlisted and won a bunch of awards all over the world for her writing, and we are really, 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 really honored and excited. But thank you for coming, Petina.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and I'm really delighted to be here. This is my first event since COVID.
What?
Yeah, my first live event since COVID, this festival. So it's just wonderful to be back in such a nourishing space as Nairobi.
Thank you. What has been a highlight for you of Nairobi this time around?
It's always the same. The fashion, the people, and the food.
Right? Mm.
And also just meeting so many writers that I've known in previous lives. And we always keep telling ourselves that we need to meet more in Africa. And this is what festivals like this bring to writers.
Yeah, this is it. So before we get into the meat of the matter, I want to talk a little bit about this podcast that we're recording today. So it's our second season of A Palace for the People. I know some people here tonight listen to the show, but some of you may not have yet. So the podcast tells stories of Kenyan history. And to do that, we use items that we have found in the library archive.
And when we began cataloging the library archive in 2019, was it? It was 2019. We began cataloging the archive so we could digitize it and so it could be available online for everybody who wants to use it and at no cost. But we'd come across this strange little bit of history, little pieces like a photo with a strange inscription or some piece of military insignia or a scrapbook of old newspapers about like the Mau Mau, for instance. And the thing that was common about every single one of them is that they were so painstakingly catalogued. Each episode of this podcast, we take one item and we use it to explore the history of Kenya. So we've done episodes about the King's African Rifles, for instance. We've done episodes about the history of the death penalty in Kenya, which was inspired by a photograph we found by Kenya's first institutional hanging. The list goes on. So if you haven't listened yet, please pause, go back to season one and catch up.
And start.
Subscribe.
So Petina, your most recent novel, Out of Darkness, Shining Light, which is available for sale here, tells the story of Halima and Jacob, two African members of David Livingstone's exploration party, as they travel from Zambia to Zanzibar to carry his body and work to be shipped back to Britain. I sent this novel to our production team on the podcast when we started this latest season for inspiration. You've said that this book took you over 20 years?
20 years, yes.
20 years to write. So much so that you published another novel.
Three other books before that.
Mm-hmm. And two works of short stories,
yeah.
I believe, yeah. And worked as an international trade lawyer in the meantime, as you do.
As one does.
As one does. What kind of research did you do about the real people behind the story, and how important are archives in this kind of writing?
I'm so delighted to hear about the podcast and the use of objects to sort of like center a story, because that's exactly what helped me understand and to write and research this book. I started writing it in 1998 on a floppy disk. Those who may be old enough to remember what a floppy disk looked like. But I had the story, but I didn't have the context in which the story was happening. The story was David Livingstone died in Chitambo, present Zambia. His companions took out his heart and his viscera and everything else, buried all that there, and then they carried his body across the continent for 9 months. So I knew the basic story. Propulsive, it's clearly an adventure story, it's an expedition in itself, but I didn't understand anything about a Victorian exploration in Africa. I didn't understand about how they moved from place to place. I didn't even understand how they had carried a body in 1873 in the heat of Africa. So I started to look at artifacts that might ground me in the story. And the first, of course, were Livingstone's own journals. I paid extraordinary amounts of money to get the first editions of his journals, and also Stanley's journals, and Speke, and Burton, because I wanted to read them in the form in which people who read them at that time would have read them. And then I found in Stanley's journal something quite extraordinary, an inventory listing the men he had traveled with on one of his expeditions and how much they had been paid. So that immediately gave me an insight into the relationships, right? So David's companions were not slaves. They were not free labor. They were employees.
Right.
Right. And the kind of employees they were cartographers. They drew maps.
Right.
They were experts in languages because many of them had been kidnapped and enslaved, right? And then rescued on the high seas, sent to India for an education, and became experts in different things, agriculture, cartography, languages. And then when the explorers refueled in India and came back to Africa, they took some of these boys with them, right? So it was a homecoming, but also a professional one, right? So these were employees. So it was artifacts like that that allowed me to really understand the sort of like the sociological aspects of what expedition life was like.
Right.
And I followed these men all over the world, you know. Mm-hmm. I spent time in Zanzibar looking at the archives there. I spent time in Zimbabwe. I spent time in the National Archives of Scotland. Mm-hmm. And in every single document, the companions were mentioned, their personalities, what kind of people they were. Somebody runs away one time. Another woman is so beautiful that she has to be married because she's causing problems for all the men. You know, so stories like that.
Okay. Those objects that you're speaking about, we've had quite similar experiences with.
Yeah, that's why we're having a bit of a moment,
yes,
aren't we?
Yeah. As you were speaking, I was actually, which is probably what you were thinking about as well, I was thinking about a ledger that we found from Ghana, I believe, part of the Africana collection at the Macmillan Memorial Library. And it was a ledger that detailed the amounts of money that were paid to ex-slave owners by the British Crown for, you know, having, I suppose, lost the labor compensation. So these kind of collections, you know, that you find when you're doing your research, that we find in the library archive, what use do you think they are to us as Africans today? And I ask that question within the context of something you've been speaking about, which is Rhodesiana, right? You've been talking about Rhodesiana. What is that, and why do you collect it?
Rhodesiana is basically a collection of all the writing and materials to do with the occupation of Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm.
So my oldest oldest book in the Rhodesiana collection is from 1863, when they were launching an expedition to find what they thought were King Solomon's mines, right?
Okay.
I collect first edition of Henry Rider Haggard, you know, King Solomon's mines and all of that, because it gives me an insight into what they thought at that time.
Right.
Because as a writer of historical fiction, I don't want to, obviously I want you, the reader, to judge the people, obviously using today's standards, but as a writer, I can't afford to do that. So I want to understand the context. But you know, speaking of these artifacts, I'm very interested in what is called by South Asian historians the subaltern view of history. I'm interested in history from the ground up. So if you want to study an army, right, if you want to understand Napoleon's wars, you don't write about Napoleon's megalomania. You write about what the French army ate when they were invading, right? You talk about what the ordinary men and women of the Roman centurions, what the men wore to battle. And this is why I love that series Rome on HBO, because it's from the perspective of Titus and Varenus, who are just centurions in the army, and not from Julius Caesar, because we know Julius Caesar's story. But if we want to really understand the story of the ordinary men and women who lived in history, we need these artifacts, because they are what anchors us into the ordinary social history. One of my favorite Rhodesiana books is called Sally in Rhodesia.
Okay.
And
hey,
it's published in about 1910, and it's about a woman who traveled as a trailing spouse to accompany her husband who was in the colonial administration. And it's a collection of her letters home to her mother in England. And it contains gems like, oh, dear mother, they're servants. They don't know how to polish the silver. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, why would a young rural boy from Mashingo or Gutu know how to polish silver? You know, but it just gives you such a wonderful insight into colonial attitudes.
Yeah.
And so all her sort of like her trouble with training her servants and all of that stuff. And then you also get to understand her own loneliness, because she was one of the very few white women who was there at the time.
Right.
So she also has her own story,
yeah,
as well as revealing through her letters the story of the people that she she came amongst.
Yeah. It's giving Happy Valley.
It is giving Happy Valley.
It's giving Happy Valley.
It is.
I'm just wondering what we call that in Kenya. Like, what's a Rhodesiana equivalent?
Is it, I guess it's, we have a whole section of Africana, maybe dedicated to it. I want to talk about the setting for Out of Darkness, Shining Light. It's set in the period leading up to full-scale British colonization, and figures like Livingstone, these explorers, missionaries, call them what you'd like to, who are kind of like mapping out the continent, they were laying out the groundwork for colonization. So I want to ask, how important is historical narrative and imagination when it comes to putting historical events and characters into their context?
Look, I obviously wanted to tell a historically accurate story. So that's where the research that I did all over the world was important. But I also wanted to tell a story that was fired by the imagination, because I can tell what David Livingstone would probably have thought about any situation, because the man was a prolific writer.
Mm.
So there wasn't much to imagine there. And in fact, each chapter in the first part is headed by a quotation from Livingstone's own journals.
Yep.
It's the African companions that I had to create and bring into being. And to do that, it meant that I had to understand the social conditions of slavery, for instance. What did it mean to be an enslaved person in East Africa in 1873? And it's very different from what it meant to be enslaved in the West African slave trade.
Yeah.
It was a different kind of slavery, because in East Africa, you had something called manumission, right? Which was, you were able to free yourself from slavery. You could buy yourself out of slavery and buy your wife and children out of slavery. So it was a different kind of enslavement. So I had to understand that, which is why when Halima speaks as freely to David Livingstone as she does, and she's his cook, she's a freed slave that she's bought. He has manumitted her. He has freed her. But she doesn't understand manumission. She thinks that she's still his slave, right? But at the same time, there's a degree of freedom that Livingstone, because of his personality, allows with his companions. So it was details like that that I had to really understand in terms of the social conditions in order to create believable characters.
Right.
The research, I keep coming back to 20 years, and you did research including learning Kiswahili.
Yes, I learned to speak very bad Swahili. I understand more than I do. But I used the Swahili Bible a lot, because in the end, this is not a spoiler, one of my characters becomes one of the translators of the Swahili, of the Bible into Swahili. And translation, by the way, translation of the Bible is what spread Christianity across the continent. So yes, I did a lot of research in the different archives, in the different libraries, and I spent half my salary one time in Geneva buying first edition of the London Illustrated Times.
Oh my goodness.
Of the funeral. So I have all these amazing amazing artifacts now, like, you know, first editions and everything else, and I'm leaving them all to the Harare City Library when I pop my clocks. I became obsessed to the point where I'm now considered an amateur expert on David Livingstone. Right.
I'll take the word amateur.
You know, if you're a person from the US and you do your Peace Corps, whatever, in Kenya for 1 year, you're a Kenya expert.
Yes.
So damn straight I'm a Livingstone expert.
Yes. You can be a Livingstone.
Yes, audience.
After 20 years,
yeah,
you can be a Livingstone
expert.
Now
it's fact.
Yeah. Yes. And I think I mentioned earlier that one of the things that I really, that really moved me was during the COVID pandemic, when the David Livingstone Museum in Blantyre, Scotland, where he was born, they have now expanded the museum to tell the story of the African Companions. So they gave me my own gallery, right, to tell those stories of the Africans that Livingston met. So I've got like a room from here to there with all these women and men.
I was gonna ask what the most surprising or like memorable thing that you found in the research is, but I think it might be the women.
Oh, absolutely the women.
Yeah.
Absolutely the women. They were a surprise because I had assumed that the business of expedition tours and so on was a very male business. And of course it was.
Yeah.
But they were women. Right. And this is what I love about the subaltern view of history, because it allows us to tell the stories of the ignored, the marginalized figures, like women, women in Rome, women in wherever. And the women in the expeditions were mainly what they called road women, because these men would get very lonely. These expeditions took 6 years, right? So you hook up with a woman here, like sailors, you know, a woman at every port. And then some of the women were employed as washers or cooks, right? Like Halima, or this lovely girl, Ntaweka, who Livingston wrote that she was so beautiful she had to marry somebody because she was causing too many problems. So things like that, you know, looking at the women, and so that was such a delight because I'm not sure that I would have been able to write it only as a story of men.
Right, right. We're going to jump to your first novel.
Must we?
We must. The Book of Memory. I'm sure some audience members have read it, which is also about histories, right? Both personal and collective. Could you tell us, for those in the audience that haven't read the book yet, what it's about and what made you want to focus on memory or forgetting?
Yeah, so at some point, when novel number 10 is written, I'm hoping, it's going to become clear that I'm writing about the same family from the Mutapa Empire, which was an empire that spread out across Zimbabwe, parts of Mozambique, Zambia, and a little bit into Botswana and South Africa. And basically that family is linked to what's called Zimbabwe's original sin. And Zimbabwe's original sin is supposed to have occurred in the 1300s. When an emperor called Nyasimba Mtota left the great Zimbabwe Empire, this beautiful ruins, to look for salt, and he went north. He got north, he sired a son called Nyanewe Matope. And Nyanewe Matope wanted the crown, but he was told that to cement his claim, he had to sleep with his sister, who was called Nyamitanehanda. Oh. Right? So she was like, I'm having none of this. This is freaking incest. Do you want to bring the curse of the ancestors down on us? So they tricked her into having sex with her brother. And when she came to, she was so outraged, she disappeared and said, Mafupa angwa chamuka, I will be back. She disappeared into the mountains and came back. Now the legend is that she came back in the first Chimurenga, the first liberation war, as a medium medium called Charwe. So she came back as an ancestral spirit called Nehanda, right? And Nehanda came back again in the second Chimurenga, the second liberation, as the animating figure in the war for independence. So the Nehanda myth has threaded its way through history, and she's kind of like our Ya Asantewa of the Ashanti, right? And in my imagining, the family that forces this horrible thing to happen has all these descendants scattered throughout Zimbabwe to whom unhorrible things happen. So there's a Ngozi spirit that plagues most of my families in my book. And the Book of Memory is about a family belief that they are plagued by that Ngozi spirit. But it will only become clear if I manage to finish book number 10. But what I wanted to do in that book, Angela and Jiru, is that I wanted to write about histories that are not written down, histories that are passed through legends, histories that are myths, right? Histories that become secrets and fears, right? You don't know why you don't talk to your uncle who lives in Kibera or who lives in, you know, Mombasa or wherever, but there's something that happened 200 years ago. That means your families can never see eye to eye. But that stuff is not recorded down anywhere. It's all felt in the blood. Sometimes it's passed on through sort of like whispers. So I wanted to write about that kind of history. What does it mean for memory? What does it mean for forgetting?
Can I stay on the topic of personal histories
a little bit?
We have this program called The Missing Bits that we quite love here at BookBank. And shout out to the archive team and the Missing Bits team.
Hey, Maureen. Hey,
so the Missing Bits was inspired by our interaction with the archive of the Macmillan. And we were beginning to create this archive, this digital archive, that was mimicking the physical archive, which excluded us by design. So we're sitting here talking about how we're decolonizing this space, but we realize very quickly we're just adding to the same problem if you're going to archive the gaps that exist in the physical archive. So we started The Missing Bits as a public call out to the public, wherever you are and whoever the public is, to come and give us their versions of what happened in Kenya at key moments in our time. I asked my mom, where were you when Kenya was declared a republic? And I was getting my hair done. That's what she told me. She was getting her hair done. And that is important because, like, back then, stuff was happening here in Nairobi, but in Kiambu, you're like, oh, we didn't even know. Oh, we're independent. Oh, that happened. You find out a week later. So The Missing Bits is really inspired by us trying to add our voices to this very, very problematic, vast archive that was meant to include us. And I want to ask you, because all of us will answer this differently, how do these missing bits add to, I guess, our own kind of notion of who we are and how that lives on beyond, like, the official record?
Oh, my gosh, that's something that I could, like, write a 20,000-word essay on. And this is the challenge I want to bring to you guys, to everybody in this audience. We are also used to our smartphones. We forget our parents' photo albums, right? I want you please to go home, if you can, and digitalize all those photo albums, because those are important parts. Those are the missing bits in our histories. Our histories are histories of pain, colonialism, liberation struggles, the gun, rigged elections, and so on. But they're also the histories of Njiru's mother getting her hair done, Angela's parents meeting. So just to close the loop a little bit, there's a wonderful Zimbabwean writer that I really loved. Her name was Yvonne Vera. And she was the director of the art gallery in our second city called Bulawayo. And she had an exhibition where she invited people living in the townships, people living in areas like Eastlands, people living in the townships. It was called Tata Camera, which means take up your camera. And she invited them to raid their parents' photo albums, right? And she blew up all these amazing pictures that she found. And it was one of the most joyful exhibitions we've ever seen in Zimbabwe, because it showed that even in times of pain, in times of crisis and conflict, people still found time for joy. Mm. How many babies were born in the colonial period? That's a lot of sex, yo.
No.
So I think if we manage to find the missing bits that complete the picture, we can move away from this idea that our history as Africans is only ever a history of pain.
Yes, yes, yes. There's also
what
joy.
What she said.
There's also lots of joy.
So, Patina, we're speaking here at the library today, where we've been adding to the catalogue of books for other people to find. And shout out to Marion.
Hey, collections team.
The collections team have done an incredible job of cataloguing books, of adding books. We have books in Braille by African authors, which we discovered is a massive gap, right? We've been prioritizing African collections because that's what's been sorely missing from these spaces. So we're on the journey. We're getting there. So hopefully there'll be more histories than the ones we walked into and found on the shelves here. You've spoken about being an insatiable reader. And I want to ask you about reading as a form of this historical exploration that we're discussing. What did you read when you were growing up? And how did those books transport you?
I read everything. I mean, when I say everything, by the time I was 11, I had read every single book in the children's section of the then Queen Victoria Library / Harare City Library, to the point where I ended up moving to the adult section and I started reading my first Agatha Christie's when I was 11. By 12, I had read almost all of them. I read Mills and Boon's I read everything. I was obsessed with history and expedition. I wanted to grow up and find the source of the Nile because I didn't realize it had been found. I was very gutted when I discovered that it had. I wanted to go to the Antarctic to search for the South Pole with, you know, I was a very imaginative and very lonely child, but all the books I read were very white in their orientation. The first book I read was Things Fall Apart when I was 12, first African book, when my teacher, Mr. Makwaremba, said, because I kept writing the stories about, you know, an orchard and skating and having a pony and all the rest of it. And I had a white alter ego called Lara, right? And she went on holidays to places that I could never have traveled to. So it was a very unfortunate reading experience from the point of view of understanding my world.
Right.
But my God, it made me a writer. Because it meant that I could enter into any imaginative world and find something there to tether myself into. I mean, I listened to classical music on the page. I was obsessed with ballet. I taught myself to dance ballet by reading books about Sadler's Wells and you know, Margot Fonteyn and Alicia Markova. All these musicians, Beethoven, Chopin, I knew their music without ever hearing it. So I was that immersed in my reading to the point where my imaginative world of reading was more real than my real world, right? To the point where my memoir is called Heaven is a Library, because it's about the 10 libraries.
Heaven
that
is the library.
And it's from a wonderful, it's a wonderful quotation by Georges-Louis Bourget, who says, I've always imagined paradise to be a kind of library. And so then from there, I went to a mission school called St. Dominic School, a Catholic school, where people made such fun of my roadie accent, but the nuns loved it and made me read at mass. But that library had only African writers. Barbara Kimenye.
Wow,
oh my God, I fell in love with Moses. Moses and the Ghost, Moses and Mildred.
Moses,
who wanted to grow up and marry Miriam Makeba and his friend King Kong. I read every single pace setter there is in the world. Meet Me in Conakry, you know, Naira
That's
Power.
Wonderful.
And I read Shona novels.
Right.
You know, every single book that was published in Zimbabwe in 1985, I had read, thanks to that library.
Wow.
It was only 5 years old. I mean, it was a tiny country, and I mean, come on, four books a year, it's not that impressive, right? So, and then I got to St. Ignatius, which is another mission school, and I just went crazy. So I read the entire world in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
So that's why I always say to myself and to my son, I want you to read Africa, yes, but I also want you to read,
the world.
Because
the
world. I want you to understand how they see us.
Yeah, that's very important. You recently wrote an article in the Financial Times, a love letter, if you will, to African writers, to your peers, who are daring to invent the future, it said. How are they and you creating an archive for future generations?
You know, that piece, it's from my memoir, because I have a whole section on what Kenya means to me as a writer, and that whole space that was created by Kwani, because it was here in Kenya at Lake Naivasha at the Kane Prize Workshop that I wrote the story that would become the title story in An Elegy for Easterling.
Wow.
Right? It was there that I met... you know, in Nairobi, after the thing, I met my darling friend Yvonne. I met Binyavanga. I met Pasalelo Kantai. I met Billy Kaora. I met that whole generation, and through them, I got looped into the Lolas, the Molara Woods, the Chimamandas. You know, it was just this incredible space where we looked at where African writing was.
Right.
And there was our grandfather, Achebe. There's our grandfather Ngugi. There was our grandfather. You know, but there were the children, you know, people like Sisilanga Rembwa, Ben Okri. But who was coming after that?
Right.
And we decided it would be us, right? And Binyavanga had this crazy idea that we should all have the same literary agent. Because then
I remember that.
If one of us rises, everybody rises with them, you know? And so we all tried to sign with David Godwin because we were completely besotted with Arundhati Roy. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful time. But then things started to fracture, and things started to fracture after the Zimbabwe election and the Kenya election. some of us got book deals and some of us didn't get book deals. Mm-hmm. So those kind of like personal jealousies kind of spoiled things a little bit. But I will honestly always think of that time as, it's the time that created me as a writer, you know? It's the time that all of my ideas about what it means to build a canon, a national canon, yes. a continental canon, came from those conversations. We were so angry with Naipaul, right? But my God, we admired his sentences. Oh, I mean, and we would argue over words. Right. It was wonderful.
I loved those arguments. I sometimes miss them. There were such spirited discussions around everything to do with writing. I was, at that time, just starting my job at Kwani. Because I started there in 2008.
Yeah. You were like a little baby.
I was like a little baby. I got baptized in fire.
Say that again, please, Pacina. She was what?
So googly-eyed. Like,
that never happened.
she was a little baby.
Never, ever. I guess I'm going to forget this.
No, but I don't know why you miss those the days, because you are continuing them.
Yes, absolutely.
This is a perfection
absolutely.
Of them. This really. These are the conversations we need.
It was,
look at what Lola is doing in Nigeria with the Ake Festival.
Yes.
You know, and I'm hearing crazy stories about festivals popping up all over the continent.
Yes.
This is the legacy.
Yes.
And it's a shame that our group sundered, but we can actually use our failures and mistakes to help guide the next generation, which is you guys.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we happily accept that mantle. Every time we talk about Binya, I get a bit teary because Binya got me off my ass in writing. And he's like, you keep talking about this writing thing. When are you going to do it? So it's really like, it's crazy to think about him as the ancestors now, but he is in this space. Binya lives in this space. He's inspired everything that Oshuka and I do, and we happily will continue. Happily, happily, happily.
But you know where you have bettered us? Because we're obsessed with writing and finding agents and publishing deals. We were obsessed with telling the proper African narrative. We were inventing the future. We were, you know, writing the wrongs of the past. You are doing the next step. You are finding audiences. You are finding readers. You are finding, and you are publishing. I mean, the publishing companies that I've heard about, that's the perfect logical step. What's the point of a nation of writers who cannot sell their own work in their own continent and don't have readers? So you are perfecting that.
Amen to that.
Amen. Getting chills up in here.
Should we start a church?
End the podcast here.
Yeah, I should start a church, the Church of Readers. Readers International.
Readers International, we like that.
Yeah, this podcast is about you. So let's talk about you. So we're going to open up to the audience for one or two questions. There's one at the back.
Hi, Bettina, and hi, everybody.
Hi,
hello.
Nadia.
Hello.
My question is about ghosts. So between like David Livingstone's body or Jane Austen's writing, it sounds that you spend a lot of time with really powerful dead things. When you're writing, how do you keep a healthy relationship between you and your current life and the ghosts that inform your craft?
Mm. Well, that's a great question. I use a lot of garlic. And I have a cross of silver. No, that's vampires. I am genuinely, and that's such a great way of looking at it, living with ghosts. I'm really obsessed with the past because I believe that understanding the past helps us locate where we are and navigate towards the future. I mean, it's a very cliched thing to say, but it happens to be true. And I'm also, I read a lot of writers, like one of my favorite writers, you know, rest her soul, Hilary Mantel. What she did with the Tudors, right? And she has this wonderful interview where she talks about how her publisher said to her, with one of her books, do you know you've written 4 pages about curtains, right? About Tudor curtains and what the curtains in the room like look like. And she said, she's got a very fluty voice. She said, I was so proud of all the curtain research and I couldn't bear for it to go to waste. But I realized I had to get Thomas Cromwell moving along and stop going on about the blithering curtains, right? So
there's the mimicking.
Yeah. No, she was wonderful. But my point really is that I am so interested in how people lived then, right, in terms of what they ate, what they talked about, what their social attitudes were, because it really can inform us about how we live now and what legacy we are bequeathing to our children. So I don't see them as ghosts. I see them as people who lived in an alternate plane, and maybe they still do live in an alternate plane, but they're very much real to me because their lives were real and their lives mattered. Mm. Thank you so much.
It's a great question. Our boss is telling us we're running out of time, but I have a very important question, and I'm gonna ask it. I want to ask about the sailors. The sailors, yes. I read in one of the articles that I was reading about you earlier that you like to travel a lot.
Oh yes.
I said I'm gonna go there
again. This is my. What I know what you want to ask about the sailors.
I want to give the audience some context. So you said that you travel a lot, and your most memorable trip is a whole month spent at sea with no Wi-Fi and some very good-looking sailors on the Atlantic. So pray tell. Yes, girl.
We want to go there.
We went there.
And not only were they very good-looking sailors, but they were French good-looking sailors. And they go like, Petina, would you like some cheese? Would you like some wine? No, it was... So, again, because of my obsession with exploration and reading and all that, when I was a child, I wanted to run away to sea with Jack Dawkins on Treasure Island and, you know, Captain, Long John Silver and all that. So I've always had a hankering for the sea. And at some point, I'm going to go to the Antarctic because, you know, one goes to the Antarctic. But so I've always loved that kind of adventure travel. But I hate cruise ships, you know, with elderly German tourists and all the rest of it. I couldn't bear to be on a cruise ship. And then I discovered that you can actually travel around the world on a container ship. Mm-hmm. Right. And I'm a trade lawyer. I like trade. So you can actually jump on a container ship. Hi. I hadn't seen you. Hi. You can jump on a container ship and as a passenger. And a container ship is allowed to take 12 passengers. More than that, they have to have a ship's doctor. Mm. Right. So I jumped on a container ship from Dunkirk in France to Martinique and Guadeloupe. And back again. Initially, I wanted to go through the Suez Canal and the Panama Canal, but it's like 56 days at sea. And I had I was responsible for a child, my son. So I told his headmaster, listen, I'm disappearing to sea for like, 28 days. I won't be contactable even on Wi-Fi. And I told my dad, try not to die before Mugabe. See you in 28 days. He managed not to die before Mugabe. So I went to sea, and it was this absolutely amazing experience with the officers and the crew. The crew are from the Philippines and India. The officers were French. It was a French container ship. And I'm looking at all these good-looking sailors. I'm like, wow, amazing. Wow, look at Tangi. Look at, wow. And then I look at the passenger manifest, and only one of them is older than me. And the best looking one was like 6 years older than my son. So I ended up taking a very motherly interest in him.
Oh my goodness.
And being very proud of how well he ate his vegetables. And no, it was a wonderful experience. And basically, I went there to write my play, Rotten Road. I went there to write my play and to write a book and to read A Suitable Boy and reread Persuasion and all the rest of it. I just love that experience so much, and I'm hoping to go back to sea one day soon.
Nice. Yeah. Well, here's to exploration. I'm afraid we're out of time. One more. We can take one more. Okay.
We can take the towers question.
The boss has said
she was never going to forgive us.
We can't not take the towers question.
You know, like I'm not going to be that guy.
Neither am I.
No,
there
I don't
are,
want
right behind you.
Tower pissed at me.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I would have been surprised if you had not let me speak.
Yeah. So
I'm really, really impressed. Petina is my good friend from long ago. Uh-huh. I shan't say anything more, but I am feeling a bit naughty, but I shan't say anything. I'm controlling myself. And one of the things that I'm really impressed by is the amount of research that you do with your work, and that you're actually physically going to Zanzibar, to Scotland, and so forth, to actually conduct the research on site. To understand, your characters. How do you do it? I have this dream of writing a play about Congo DRC, before the Portuguese have arrived, they first encountered you know, the Westerners, and they've got ambassadors. You know, they've you know, it was so developed that they also had ambassadors in Europe, etc. And then poop, their ambassadors become slaves. You know, I've just got this thing in my head one day. How did you get this research done? How do you do this? You've mentioned a little bit with a ship, so we understand that you are a bit wild, but so tell us a little bit about how do you do that?
Stella, thank you so much for that brilliant question. What it is really is that I'm at heart a nerd. I really am a nerd. I can spend a month on my own reading or writing or thinking or whatever, right? And I am also an obsessive. I've got a bit of OCD. Thanks, Mom, an inheritance from my mother. And so because I'm obsessive, even if it's just for myself, a reader doesn't need to know that I went to Zanzibar to actually see Livingstone's house. But I want to, because I want to be able to say, I saw Livingstone's house. So because I have that, my son and I, for instance, we now quote Game of Thrones to each other in ordinary conversation, because I've seen it about 39 times, you know, every episode. Because I want to understand how that meat got into that sausage. What makes it so good? And why the fifth season is so crap. But that's another conversation. So if I'm into something, I go all in. I go all in. If only just to satisfy my own curiosity, because I'm very curious. I want to understand why things are the way they are. And even if I'm not going to win a quiz or write an exam about it, I just want to know. So that's the attitude to which I bring my research. And this is why, for me, it was important to go all over, basically to go to every place associated with David Livingstone. Yeah. Thank you so much.
That's my cue to say thank you. Thank you to everyone for coming to this event. Thank you for spending the weekend with us at NBO Lit Fest. Please join me in giving our thanks to our guest, Bettina Gapa, for her time. Woo! Our producers, Mae Francis and Ida Holinambi. Woo! SwizzNet Productions for recording this entire event.
Thank you. A Palace for the People is supported by British Council's Cultural Protection Fund, administered in partnership with the UK's Department for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport. You can find us everywhere that podcasts live, and I mean everywhere. And the podcast is also available on our website, bookbank.org. Do not forget to subscribe. This is it for season 2, folks.
It's a wrap. Thank you, Bettina. And thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, and the lovely audience.